Thank you so much for the wonderful music and worship experience we've had already this morning. I'm always blessed by it. Well, this morning, I want to preach. I've got four opportunities to preach before the new pastor arrives, and I want to tell you, I think you made a good decision. I was here last week and heard his sermon, thought he did a great job, and just know you want to thank the committee. I don't know if you did that last week or not, but they worked hard for, I guess, about 10 months now, or 8 months, something like that. Long time. Felt like several years, right? With those members who are on the pulpit committee, would you please stand? Let's just thank them this morning publicly for the job they did. Well, the sad thing for me is I'm out of work again now. Seems like that happens every time I go to an interim. And I want to thank you for allowing me to come and be with you for these 5 or 6 months. And I've had a wonderful time and have enjoyed getting to know you. You've got a wonderful staff. I've got four messages left because I had some other things planned, but we came back early with the pastor, and I'm grateful for that. And so what was going to be a series is now just going to be one sermon. I'm going to preach this morning on the subject of choices. Next week, I want you to come back and be preaching out of John 8 about one of the greatest stories in the New Testament, story about the woman taken in adultery. The week after that, if you can only be here for one of those weeks, that's the week you want to come. I'm going to preach on confession from 1 John 1:9, and I promise you it's a message that every believer needs to hear. It can make all the difference in your life spiritually. And then the last Sunday I'm going to be here, I'm going to preach about how you can make Tim Barnett a success as pastor here at Five Forks Baptist Church. There are some things you can actively do. But this morning, I want to preach on the subject of choices, all right? I wish, really do mean this with all my heart, wish you could have known my mother. I was going to a Christmas Eve service at Brushy Creek. I was still pastoring at the time. And it was Christmas Eve 2013. And just as I walked out the door to go to that Christmas Eve service, my sister called me and she said, Frank, that's what they call me, and said, you need to come to Anderson. We've just taken Mama by ambulance. And I went there to the hospital that Christmas Eve night and spent the night with her. Her calcium levels were up. She was talking out of her head. And it was just terrible, terrible evening. Next morning, about 8 o'clock, Christmas morning, the doctor had run a bunch of tests during the night, and he came back and told me and my family, your mother has multiple myeloma. She died June the 4th, or 3rd rather, of that following year. So she lived about 6 months. One day, when we were in hospice the last 6 or 7 weeks of her life, I'm there by her bedside, and I'm just looking at my mother. And I've seen folks come in, they prodded her, and they poked her, and they've done just unspeakable things to her. And people have come to see her, they visited, whether they were nurses, or they were doctors, or they were friends of hers from her church. Every time someone would enter that room, big smile would come on her face. And she'd treat them with such kindness, when she was being treated at times so inhumanely almost. And I just wondered to myself as I watched her lay there in that bed. She was sleeping at this moment. And big tears just began to stream down my face. And I just wondered, how in the world does she do this? How does she continually smile, continually be pleasant, continually be loving, continually be kind, never a harsh word come from her lips? Always so contented. I can tell you this, and I'm not saying because I'm her son. Everyone who knew her would say this to you. She was the most contented human being I've ever known in all my life. And I got to tell you, I just don't know very many human beings who are contented. And I'm certainly not among them. I left home when I was 18 to go to college. And from the day I left home until the day she died in my early 60s, we never exchanged a harsh word. You can believe that or not, but that's the truth. Not one time did we ever exchange a harsh word. I was talking to my son and my daughter about that after she passed. And they said, well, you know, Dad, we didn't either. And my wife would tell you the same. And my brother would tell you the same. And my sister would tell you the same. And believe me, it wasn't because of anything about us, because we argue with everybody else in our lives, right? We fussed and fought with each other for years and years and years, all of us. But never my mom. She always had a filter. She always knew when she had said enough. She could control her tongue. And I just wondered, how in the world is it that she is able to do that? Because to be quite honest, our lives were just vastly different in so many ways. I was given every opportunity. I was afforded the opportunity to go to college and go to seminary and to get an education. But my mother was not afforded hardly any of those opportunities. She dropped out of high school at 16, got married, had me when she was 18 years of age. Her father had been in the Navy during World War II, was away from home during World War II for almost 4 years of her childhood. My father was a first sergeant in the Army. 3 times she saw him go to Korea, twice, and Vietnam once. She raised 3 children pretty much on her own. My mother was a tough, tough, tough cookie. And I just wondered, how is it she does this? And as I watched her in that bed, it suddenly dawned on me. And as a result, I ended up writing a book about it. And it was called Choices. Because what I realized as I looked at my mother is this. She lived her life the way she lived her life because she made a choice to live that way. She controlled her tongue because she made a choice to control her tongue. And she was kind to people because she made a choice to be kind to people. She was contented because she made up her mind she was going to be. And those choices reigned and ruled in her life. Most of us, if I can be honest with you for a few minutes this morning, we think our lives are determined by fate, by circumstance, and by the breaks we receive in life. By fate, I mean those things that are out of our control. Now, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you this morning as I talk about choices, and I hope you'll hear what I'm saying. Fate does determine our existence to some degree. In other words, there are some things that we don't have any control over. Absolutely no control over. You were not able to choose the time period in which you would be born. You had no say in that. You didn't have any say about who would be your mother or who would be your dad. You have absolutely no say over who your brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and family extended and immediate will be in life. Absolutely no say in that whatsoever. You can choose your friends, but you've heard it said many times, you cannot choose your family. You didn't get to choose to be white or black or Indian or Asian. That wasn't up to you. It was decided for you. You had no say about what state you would be born in or what nation you would be born in or what the political system of the nation you would be born in would be. And so there's a certain amount of things in life over which we have absolutely no control. Have you ever thought about that? And then secondly, we think not only is life as it unfolds the result of fate, it's also the result of circumstances. And by that I mean how we're treated by people. If we're treated good or if we're treated bad. Because I got to be honest with you, there's some of you in this room who you have received every opportunity. You're kind of like me. You've been blessed. I mean, people have smiled on you and they've treated you well. I owe so many people in life who gave me opportunities to preach when I was just a kid and then as a young man and educational opportunities. And a lot of you are like that. I mean, you had mothers and dads who encouraged you and lifted you up. My mother was my greatest cheerleader. My mother, I can't tell you how many times she would look at me and she said, You can do that. She was always an encouragement. And some of you have had that same kind of experience, right? Just shake your head yes. That means yes and no and don't know, right? But can I be honest with you? That's not been everybody's lot in life. And those of us who've been blessed, we kind of tend to think, man, what I've experienced in life is what everyone's experienced in life. But it's not. There are a lot of folk who in life, if they look at their life and they're honest, they'd say, you know what? I've had far more people to beat me down than to build me up. I've had just lots and lots and lots of folk who told me I couldn't instead of I could. I had folks who discouraged me and who told me I was fat, I was ugly, I was too skinny, I was too tall, I was too short. They said everything in the world about me. That's some folk testimony today. You've had to overcome your circumstances rather than be encouraged by your circumstances. And then finally, some of us think that life is the result of the breaks we receive, just the luck of the draw. I mean, let's just be honest. Breaks do impact our lives, don't they? Some of us have invested in the market only to find that 2 weeks later it crashes, right? Have you ever had that happen? You didn't have a crystal ball. You couldn't see that coming. And yet you've had some good things happen. You showed up for that job interview the moment the job was posted, and it was yours. And others of you have gotten jobs only to find out 3 weeks later that they're closing the plant down and you're losing your benefits. And so breaks do affect us in life. But I hope you'll hear this when I tell you of all the factors in life, and those are all factors, things we control, things that others do to us, things others do for us, the breaks in life, all those things play a role in my life, who I turn out to be and what I do with my life. But I want to tell you something. Far above all of those, the most important factor in life in determining the course your life takes, you know what it is? It's the choices that you personally make. I want to tell you, God has given us the ability to choose. Aren't you grateful for that? He lets us make choices. You know how I know that? In part, I know it because of the Bible. Because you see, the Bible is God's book to us, and it does a number of things for us. It tells us about God's redemptive story, but it also is a handbook for how you do life. And when you read the Bible, page after page after page, you read this kind of thing, do this. How many of you ever read one of those do this pages? Can I see it? The Bible tells us, live this way, do this. Be kind, be humble, be gentle. Walk with God, pray, read. It tells us how to live our lives. But the Bible also has prohibitions, doesn't it? It says, don't do this, and it's very, very clear. It says, hey, here's a warning, don't live this way. Well, listen, how unfair would it be for God to tell us to do anything or to avoid other things if, in fact, we had no choice? But we do have a choice. We have the opportunity, every one of us, every day, to decide what we want to do with our lives in life. There's some of you who say, oh, you'll just have to overlook me because I've got a bad temper. That's my temperament. Can I tell you something? You choose to have a bad temper. It can be your temperament. It could have been the environment you grew up in, and all those things could have contributed to that. But understand this. At the end of the day, you are responsible for your temper because you make a choice to either act out or not. Some of you say, oh, you know, I can't help it. I'm just candid. I just speak what's on my mind. I say what I think. I don't pull any punches. I want to tell you something. You have a choice to be rude or a choice to be kind. You have a choice to have a filter or not have a filter. You have a choice to be injurious with your tongue or to be helpful with your tongue. But it's all about our choices in life. I'm going to tell you something today, and you may not like this, but you get the life you choose. If your life is overwhelmingly crummy, for the most part, you have you to thank for that. If there was one message I could preach today, I thought about this many, many times, you'll say, you're weird to think this, but because of what I do, I'm a preacher, I think about these kind of things. If I had the opportunity to gather all American families, husbands and wives, parents under one roof, and I had the chance to preach to them, I know beyond any measure of doubt what I'd preach. You know what I'd preach? I would say to those parents, if you don't do anything else in life, you convince your children that they have a choice about how they live. And listen, there's a second part to this. And that their choices have consequences. I'm going to tell you today, there's nothing more important for you to drill into your children than that thought. You have a choice. You don't have to do what others are doing. You don't have to do what your peers are doing. You don't have to do what the devil is tempting you to do. You don't have to do what the media and Hollywood tell you to do. You get a choice. But understand this, whatever you choose, there are going to be consequences to those actions. And if there's anything I drill down on with those parents, here's what it would be. Don't ever take away the consequences of your child's actions. You do them a huge, huge disfavor. Don't rescue your child. When they get in trouble in school, they get in trouble with the law, they get in trouble at church, don't rush in and say, I've got to be their savior. I don't see them hurt. I don't see them embarrassed. I don't see them lose this opportunity. I'm going to rescue them. I'm going to tell you something. When you do that, you do your child a great, great, great disservice. Now, let me show you that. I want us to look this morning at two biblical characters. I'm not going to read much scripture. I'm going to read one verse and I'm going to read it in just a few minutes. But I want to talk about two biblical characters that you know very, very well. The first is Samson. How many of you know about Samson? Raise your hand if you know about Samson. Everybody here? That's what I thought. Samson was an Old Testament judge. He was one of the last of the judges. These judges didn't wear long black robes. They didn't sit on judicial benches with gavels. These judges were warriors. It was before Israel had a king. They had just left the land of Egypt, wandered 40 years, gone in, taken possession of the Holy Land, were without a king, and so God raised up men who were deliverers. That's what those judges were. They delivered their people, the nation of Israel, the Hebrew people, from their surrounding enemies. And one of those judges was a man by the name of Samson. Now, what we know best about Samson was this. Boy, he was a specimen. I mean, he had huge muscles. Strongest man to ever live. Incredibly strong. Tell you something you may not know about him if you haven't read the text carefully. Handsome dude. Ladies man. Looker. Women were attracted to him, and believe me, he was attracted to women. He loved the ladies. Got him in lots and lots of trouble. Samson was not only brawn, he was brains. Clever beyond your wildest imaginations. Loved riddles. Loved writing poetry, apparently. Samson, what do you know about him? Let's just have an open conversation. What do you know about him? Tell me something he did. Anybody here, just real short, you can't tell me the whole story, just the short synopsis. What do you know about him? Say that one time. Wasn't supposed to cut his hair. God gave him the vow of a Nazarite. Don't cut your hair. Don't drink alcohol. What else you know about him? Killed a lion with his bare hands. What else? Jawbone. 1,000 Philistines. What else? There you go. Anything else? I'm sorry? Delilah cut his hair. Yeah. Let me tell you. This man had incredible talents, but he made some horrible, horrible, horrible poor choices. And as a result, you come to the last chapter the Bible talks about his life, and you know what you see in this guy? His eyes are gouged out. His head is shaved. He's in shackles. He's beaten senseless to a pulp. This man who had destroyed others is now destroyed himself. Can you imagine we get a 2020 truck? They have their cameras, their microphones. They go to the prison cell where he's being kept. There he is, this great, huge, good-looking guy. Now his clothes are bloodstained. His eyes are gouged out. Can you imagine how that must have looked? Boy, he's a pitiful sight. And they take their microphone, the interviewer does. The cameraman has his camera on Samson and the interviewer. And he walks up and he takes the microphone, he puts it in Samson's face. And he says, Samson, man, what happened to you? How did you get this way? Look at, you're a warrior. Man, you're a man's man. What happened? If you'd seen him 2 or 3 days after he was captured, after they got out of his eyes, you know what I think his response might have been? I think there's a real good chance from just all the counseling I've done through the years, I wouldn't be a bit surprised that this is the answer he'd have given you. It was the Philistines. They're a barbaric bunch of people. They've always been the enemy of God's people. They've always been my enemy. They've always hated me. They did this to me. They used Delilah. She tricked me and they deceived me. They acted like cowards. They sprang out from nowhere. My strength was gone. They cruelly, inhumanely gouged out my eyes. It was so painful. They're to blame for this. They did this to me. And then Delilah, she had a hand in that. In fact, every woman I've ever known, they've turned against me other than my mother. I married a woman. She betrayed me. I went after this prostitute. She betrayed me. I went after Delilah, and I thought she was the love of my life, and I was laying my head in her lap, and she asked me about my strength, and I told her a lie at first, and then she tried to utilize that to disarm me, but I told her a lie, and so it didn't work. And a second time I did that, and a third time I did that, and a fourth time I got so worn out, I finally told her the truth that my strength was in my hair. She cut my hair. They rushed in. They did this to me. It was that treacherous, villainous woman, Delilah. Now, probably the average reporter would just say, okay, well, thank you for that. But if somebody was a real, true reporter and they'd done a lot of investigating, you know what they might have asked? They might have leaned in and said, Samson, with all due respect, and we don't mean to make your misery any worse, didn't your mom and dad tell you not to get mixed up with Philistines? Didn't your mom and dad tell you not to chase after that first Philistine woman, that she was bad for you? Yeah. Samson, didn't God even commission you to be the deliverer of Israel and told you that he was going to use you to fight the Philistines and they would always be your enemy? Didn't God tell you that? Yeah. And Samson, Delilah, another of these Philistine women, you knew you couldn't trust her. In fact, she asked you what was the source of your strength, and you made up some crazy answer about bowstrings, fresh bowstrings, and she tried to subdue you with those bowstrings. That should have been a hint to you, don't you think? And then she tied you with fresh ropes. And then you escaped. And then you began to flirt with disaster because you went from bowstrings to ropes to your hair, and you talked about those 7 braids. You were getting dangerously close. Why did you even go there? I don't know. I was foolish. And then at last you told her the strength, the secret of your strength was in your hair. And when you did, man, she had your hair shaved while you slept. Samson, I got to ask you, isn't this really your doing? Didn't you bring this about? Isn't it amazing how in life, when things go bad for us, we want to blame our dads and our mamas and our upbringing and where we grew up and what happened in our life and who did what for us, instead of saying, you know what? I made some terrible choices. This is on me. It's on me. I want you to look at a second biblical character, a New Testament character, not nearly as well known as Samson, not as popular, but one you'll know the name Pilate. He's the governor who hears Jesus' case. He's the one they show up to early that morning, the Sanhedrin. They have Jesus under arrest. They demand he be put to death. Wow, what's the charge? He says he's a king. Pilate asked him about it. Are you a king? That's what you say. He looked at the way he was dressed. He saw his mannerisms. This is a sophisticated guy. He's been around a while. It's not his first trip to the rodeo. Pilate knows. He's not a king, not in the sense that we think about kings. This is a dispute that is religious in nature. They're jealous and envious of this man. He's a kind, gentle man. And you know what the Bible tells us about Pilate? Pilate actually wanted to find Jesus innocent. He did, in fact, find him innocent. And he delivered that news to them, but they wouldn't hear of it. And he even tried to find an escape route for Jesus. Well, what if I release Jesus and we'll crucify Barabbas? To his utter horror and shock, they reversed it and said, no, crucify Jesus and release Barabbas. He couldn't believe they said that. If we were to take that same 2020 camera and go in and interview Pilate a few days, few weeks, few months after his verdict about Jesus, take him out and scourge him, crucify him, we could probably find him in his bedroom, and you know what he'd be doing? He'd be there by a basin of water, and he'd be washing his hands. Because no matter how hard he washed, he wasn't able to get the blood of Jesus off his hands. You see, he didn't need anybody to accuse him. He knew in his mind and heart he was a coward. He knew he had the authority. He was the only one who did, who could have changed Jesus' circumstances. All he had to say is, no, he's innocent. I quit him. Let him go. That's all he had to do. But the crowd was growing angrier and angrier, and he knew, they're going to make trouble for me, and they're going to report this to Rome. And then they kind of changed the charge. They said, he's a traitor. He's wanting to overthrow Caesar. And he thought, man, if Caesar hears of this, he'll just say, why'd you even worry about that Jew? Just put him to death, man. Be done with it. And so he turns on an innocent man. He's been charged with the responsibility of being a judge. I mean, he has a responsibility to the people of Judah and the people of Galilee, to Rome for that matter, to mete out justice. And yet he finds Jesus guilty when he knows he's innocent. Or imagine how he felt on the inside. So you take your camera and you go to Pilate and you say to Pilate, Pilate, man, why'd you do this? Well, it was the Jews. It's those religious nutcases. It was a Sanhedrin. They're so jealous and envious of anybody. And he'd have done his best to blame it on them. But at the end of the day, if that reporter had had the nerve, he could have looked at Pilate and said, Pilate, can I ask you something? Isn't it just that you lacked integrity? Isn't it just that you were cowardly in upholding your responsibility? You were charged the responsibility of justly judging human beings, and you failed. You sent an innocent man to his death. Pilate, I got news for you. This is on you. Let me ask you, what do we learn about choices from these two stories? I'm going to tell you three things and I close, so listen carefully. Here's the first. No one is responsible for my choice except me. I get to choose. If I say evil things, if I use profanity, if I lose my temper, can I tell you something? It's on me. Doesn't matter what the people around me have done, how they've tried to incite me, it's on me. I made a choice to do that. If I steal, it's on me. If I have an adulterous affair, doesn't matter how many times this gal might have come on to me, doesn't matter what she said to distract me, doesn't matter how she might have really turned the tide and made it difficult for me to say no. It's on me. Do you understand that? Not somebody. It's on me. I'm the only human being in this world who gets to choose what I do. Now, I can surrender that choice to you, and oftentimes we do. In fact, some of you are going to do that today. As soon as this service is over, you're going to go get in your cars, and you're going to go to eat, some of you, and you know what's going to happen. One of you are going to look at them and say, where do you want to eat? And they're going to say what? I don't care. If you ever open a restaurant, name it that. I don't care. It'll be full of people. You see, I can forfeit my choice to another. I can default, a good computer word. I can default to another, but I don't tell you something. At the end of the day, that was my decision to default. It's my decision. Tim, you want to make that decision for me? Okay. But can I tell you something? It's not on him, it's on me. I'm responsible for every decision in my life. Samson, Pilate, David, Joshua, remember Joshua? Joshua turned to the nation of Israel and said, hey, you do whatever you think's best, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Jesus, when he's in the desert, he could have sinned. He could have given in to the wiles of the devil. But Jesus chose to do the right thing. When he's at the rock of agony in the Garden of Gethsemane the night before he dies, he's praying for the will of the Father to be done. He's so intense in his praying, he sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. But in the end, Jesus does the right thing. You know why? Because he knows, this decision's on me. Peter, when he denied Jesus, his choice. Judas, when he betrayed him, his choice. And I'm going to tell you something. Every decision you'll ever make in your life, good or bad, it's on you. It's on you. You're responsible for your decision. Secondly, our decisions, our choices have consequences. Now, I'm begging everyone to listen to me, but especially all of our teenagers and 20-somethings, please hear this today. Our choices have consequences. Some of them are big and some of them are small. If you decide to go to Taco Bell today and I'm really wanting to go get a hamburger, not very big consequence. I may just go away saying, I wish we'd had that other. I didn't like this very good, but no biggie. But I'm going to tell you something. If I cheat on my spouse today, that has huge consequences. If I marry the wrong person, date the wrong person, get too involved with the wrong person, huge consequences. Huge consequences. I'm warning you today, you can make 1,000 good decisions, and sometimes that 1,000 good decisions have very little consequence on your outcome of life. But you can make one single wrong decision and destroy your life. Do you know that? I've seen it happen a lot. Where men, I know men today, I could call their names, you would know them. Men in ministry who made a lot of good decisions. And that one wrong decision in their life has overshadowed all the good decisions they ever made. So the consequences of your actions really matter. Galatians 6:7, this is what it says. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Jesus referred to that. It was the law of the harvest. He utilizes the principle of the law of the harvest in a number of his teachings. And it's just so simple. It applies all the time to all of us. Whatever you sow, that you reap. Every time you sow, there's a consequence. Every time you make a decision, there's a consequence. And you've seen that play out in your own life. How many of you have ever lost your cool and you've allowed your mouth to overload your brain and you've just spurt something out? And it was so hurtful, and the moment it came out, you wanted to get it back in. And you even apologize, but you look in the face of the one to whom you said it, especially if it was your wife or your child or your husband, and you can tell, boy, the hurt's already there. It's been done. It's hard to get that paste back in the tube, isn't it? Because it's out there already. That's the consequences of our actions. I'm going to tell you something. If there's anything this generation of Americans, and even the last two or three generations of Americans, has not realized, it is that there are consequences to our actions. Parents, I'm begging you today, make sure your children understand the consequences of their action. And they'll never get that if you're constantly rescuing them. And I got to be honest with you, most Christian parents I see today, we're in the rescue business. We do it, we say, for our child's sake, but you know what I've come to believe? I think more often than not, we do it for our sake. We don't want to be embarrassed by them. We don't want to think my child would make a C. My child would not do their homework. My child would get in trouble. My child would steal. My child would do this or my child would do that. And so when it starts at a young age and we keep rescuing them, when they get older, can I tell you something? You're going to be rescuing them into their 30s and 40s and 50s. And you know what I'm telling you is the truth. Some of you today in this room have done that very thing, and you live to regret it. You ought to tell your children that. You ought to teach your grandchildren that. I was preaching a message in a revival on the other side of town, I guess now probably close to 20 years ago. That day when I was preparing the message to go preach that night, there was a story on the news about a school in Alabama. A 14-year-old boy took a shotgun from his grandfather's closet, went to school, and shot at some folks, hit one child, and killed them. They had him in handcuffs. They were taking him out to the car, and one of those cameras was there from the news, and a reporter stuck a mic in his face. The little boy's crying as they put him in this police car, and they said, "What do you have to say?" You know what the little boy said? I'll never forget so long as I live. I've used this illustration a number of times. The little boy looked at the reporter and said, "I just want to go home to my grandpa. Why don't they just let me go and let me go home to my grandpa? I just want to go home to my grandpa." And when I saw that, I thought to myself, you know what? He doesn't get it. He's never going home to his grandpa. Those days are over. His life is over. He didn't realize there's a consequence to me taking a shotgun and shooting into a crowd and killing somebody. You can't just say, "Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that." It's done. You understand that? It's done. We must bear the consequences of our actions. And thirdly, good choices lead to a good life. Please listen to this. Poor choices lead to a life of undue heartache. The book of Proverbs, written by Solomon, is a book about what? You know, it's a book about, say the one word. I heard somebody say wisdom. That's it. But I want to tell you this, and I'm going to bring it to a close real soon now. When we hear the word wisdom, we think of this white-headed guy with a long white beard in a robe who is very philosophical. He's a sage. Ask him, he knows anything. That wasn't what Solomon had in mind at all. The Hebrew word that Solomon uses, you know what it means? Skillful. And if you look at the context in which that word is used, how it's applied, it was used of men who were surgeons as they used the scalpel. You put a scalpel in my hand, you better get back. But you put a scalpel in the hand of a skilled surgeon, and they knew exactly where to make the cut and exactly how much tissue to cut out so that they will extend your life rather than take your life. They used the scalpel skillfully. It was used of jewelers, men who would take a diamond or a gem and take a chisel and a hammer and place it exactly right on that diamond and with a single tap split it into multiple smaller diamonds, increasing the value rather than decreasing the value. Everybody can't do that. I've got a chisel and a hammer. Don't let me get a hold of your diamond. But a skillful jeweler can do that. It was used of navigators. When before we had GPS and all the equipment we have today, even compasses, they would navigate ships from one place to another by looking up at the heavens and seeing the constellations. They were skilled. And what Solomon is saying is this: live your life in such a fashion as to live skillfully so that you navigate the course of life. Because listen, it's tricky, isn't it? Boy, life is tricky. Even if you're slowing down and reading the Word of God and praying and doing the best you can do, it's still tricky. So he says, live life skillfully so that you maneuver around the hazards and you live a pleasant life. And the opposite of that is like the guy or the gal who lives like a bull in a china shop. And you know what I'm talking about, right? You've seen those folk. Listen, they just think it's just breaks. Everybody's against me. I never caught a break. Nah. They just go headlong into one problem after another problem after another. And their mess is strewn all about their life because they're always stubborn. They're never learning. They're never taking advice. They're always doing it their way. They can't listen to God or to others who love them. Is that the case in your life? Do you like your life? Now, please hear me as I close. Do you like your life? If not, why in the world not choose today to get another life? Why not stop blaming others for your failures and start making better choices? If you don't like your life, change it. Make better choices. Can I just ask you to do a quick inventory of your life? Are you making good choices spiritually? Are you making good choices about your marriage? Are you making good choices about your sexuality? Are you making good choices financially? Are you making good choices about your social life? Are you making good choices about who your friends are? Because I'm going to tell you something. You choose the wrong people to hang out with to be your friends, and boy, you're inviting trouble. Are you making good choices in life? Why not accept responsibility for your bad choices and ask forgiveness and begin today making better choices? I say this and I'm done. It is never too late to do the right thing. I meet so many people when I was pastoring full time and in the office, and people would come by and I'd counsel with them. I meet so many people who would just say, "My life's a mess. There's no use. I made so many bad choices. It's just a mess. It could never be." That's crazy. If bad choices led to the bad life you're in, good choices will lead out of that bad life into a better life. It's never too late for you to begin to do the right thing. And some of you today, to be honest, you need to put on the brakes because, and I'm just going to be real candid, it's not I've got a crystal ball. It's not anybody's called me about anybody in this room. I don't know anything about any of your lives personally, but I'm going to tell you something. In a room with this many people, there are some of you, if you don't stop today right where you're at, you're going to have an affair. There are some of you, if you don't stop right where you are today, you're going to lose your family. A year from now, you won't be with your kids. You're about to make some decisions that will cost you and cost you dearly. There are some of you started down a road financially. You're spending like a drunken sailor. And it's going to cause you to end up bankrupt. It's going to end up causing your family maybe to break apart. There are some of you neglecting to do some things spiritually in life. They're going to take you away from God. And some of you today, you're just hanging on by the threads right now. But a year from now, you're going to be way away from God. And you're going to wonder, how in the world did my life get in this mess it's in? I'm going to tell you the thing for you to do today is to say, I'm responsible for my choices. God, I made some bad choices. I'm begging you to forgive me. And I want to turn that around today. I'm going to begin to make better choices. I'm going to make a promise to myself, to my family, to God. I'm going to begin making better choices today. I'm going to take responsibility for my life beginning today. Would you do that? We're going to have a hymn of invitation. If the Spirit of God has spoken to your life, you come even now as we stand and sing. Let's stand. Let me pray with you while they come. Father, move on this group of people today through the power of your Spirit and draw them, Lord, to confess sin to you, to just acknowledge, Lord, the consequences of their action are on them. And Lord, to begin today to make better choices, would you empower them to make better choices? We ask it in your name for your sake. Amen. Thank you.